everyone, and welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. Our mission is to provide stories and resources that will give you inspiration to explore all of the possibilities that your life can be. The possibilities are limitless, and guess what? So are you. It begins with believing. Believing in yourself, believing that the future is yours to write, believing that you can not only write your desired future, but that you have everything that you need to write it, edit it as needed, and fully and wonderfully live it. And you don't have to wait. You can start today. The pen truly is in your hand. I cannot wait to share this week's conversation with you. My guest today is a minister and an attorney. Now, his path has had some interesting twists and turns. After an addiction to prescription opioids and serving almost 14 months in a federal prison from 2006 and 2007 for a white-collar crime that he committed in 2001 when he was an attorney, he started his own reentry, earning a Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York, majoring in social ethics. After graduating from divinity school, he was called to serve at an inner-city church in Bridgeport, Connecticut, as associate minister and director of prison ministries. He then co-founded Progressive Prison Ministries, Inc., the world's first ministry dedicated to serving the white-collar justice community. His name is Jeffrey Grant, and I think that you'll see that how the challenges he faced are rather universal in nature. Jeff, good to see you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bobby.
I'm so glad to have you on the show. And I know it was, Craig introduced us, mm-hmm, which I thought was very, very generous. So if you want, would you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and your story?
Sure. I'm a lawyer and I'm a minister, ordained minister. And for a lot of years in my story, I didn't know if I would ever be a lawyer again. My story really goes back to 1992 when I had a sports injury. And I developed a dependency to opioids.
Oh.
So I was really, if I considered myself a victim, which I don't, but I could be, you know, cast as an early victim of the opioid crisis because I had friends who were doctors who prescribed opioids to me on demand for 10 years. Usually on a weekly basis, sometimes more often, actually. And as that 10 years unfolded, basically from 1992 to 2002, I just became more and more addicted, less present, physical manifestation, emotional. I was unable to show up. I had about over 20 people working at my law firm. And I was also general counsel to some of the largest real estate companies in Metro New York.
Wow.
And after about 7 years or so, it was just a complete collapse. And one day, my office manager came to me and said to me that we were running out of cash and we weren't going to make payroll that week. And we had a very, very active, very successful practice, but of course, suffering from my inability to be present. And I instructed her to borrow money from the client escrow fund, which of course is illegal and unethical. But I was crazy. And I did it. I did it a few more times. But of course, once that starts to happen, things just unravel pretty quickly.
Yeah, the doors open.
Oh, yeah. And there was a grievance against me not long thereafter. And they wanted to see 6 months of records. And once the grievance committee got the records, it was just a countdown until a collapse.
Yeah.
While I was fighting it during that time, 9/11 happened, which I took very hard, as did many people in direct New York, the radius around Ground Zero. And I applied for an SBA disaster loan, like they're offering now for COVID,
right,
like PPP loans. And I lied on the application and said I had an office about a block from Ground Zero.
Man.
Which I didn't need to do because I was close enough to the city that they would have approved me anyway. But I was nuts. And I got the loan. It didn't help, as it wouldn't have helped save the business. And in July of 2002, I resigned my law license. And on that day, I got my last prescription of opioids, waited till my family fell asleep, and took the entire bottle and tried to kill myself.
Oh,
and that was that was the end of my first life. That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, oh my goodness.
So that's the deep back story.
Yeah.
As to how I got into this mess, but of course I had no way of knowing what an incredible life would spring out of that.
Right. Well, Jeff, I mean, oh my goodness, thank you for sharing that. So it was in 92 when you had the sports injury.
Yeah.
In prior to that, no, like probably never taken any kind of pain meds or anything like that.
Well, I was a normal kid growing up on Long Island and outside New York. I mean, I had my share of recreational drugs and drinking, but nothing so highly addictive, nothing so intense. Yeah.
Yeah. So as that was going along, were you aware that it was an addiction?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But you just had friends who would continue to write you.
I didn't care. It was in the throes of that addiction, it became more important to me than anything. My success, my family, my love for my kids. It became the next fix was more important than anything.
Yeah. So July 2002, I almost said 2022, 2002, you hit this rock bottom. What happened next?
A few days later, I was in rehab.
Good.
And by the way, that'll be 20 years ago this summer. So I'd never taken another illicit drug or I never drank again for almost 20 years now.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. But they put me on meds for bipolar disorder. And so I didn't really know that I had been self-medicating for what was a pretty advanced case of bipolar disorder. And when I look back on it, of course, everything was there. The mania, the depression, everything was there. But I would say within days, my thinking started to clear up and I came out of rehab and started going to AA. And at first I went probably three times a day.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was a full-time job recovering. Even as I was losing my family, my home, things were collapsing, but I was staying sober. And about 20 months later, so I was almost 2 years sober. I got a call from a federal agent on my cell phone telling me there was a warrant out for my arrest in connection with the SBA loan I had taken out.
Yeah.
And gave me a couple of weeks to turn myself in. I hired a lawyer and drove down to Manhattan to 500 Pearl Street, you know, the federal courthouse in Manhattan. And it was like a war zone down there, still from 9/11, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the whole thing you saw on TV with the checkpoints and the submachine guns. And I definitely felt like the worst person in the world. You know, it was, I got arrested. First time I'd ever been handcuffed and put in a cell. And I got arraigned that day and released with the intention to plead guilty and work out whatever was going to be worked out by my lawyers. And then it took about two more years to get sentenced. And yep.
Wow.
Yep. Things were pretty nuts in the country back then. And so I reported to prison, to a federal prison out in Pennsylvania on Easter Sunday of 2006. So that was a little prophetic for sure.
Yeah, I would say. But 2006. Wow. Okay. Yeah,
so all that time went by and I served 13 and a half months in a low security prison, not a camp, you know, but an actual prison with bars and controlled movements and everything. I wasn't lucky enough to get designated to a camp. And after 13 and a half months, I came out and I had home confinement and halfway house and then 3 years of federal probation and started my life over and was not nearly prepared for the adventure it was going to become. I didn't know if I would ever have a life again.
Yeah. So I'm curious about something. I had no idea that it would take that long between, you know, pleading guilty and then actually beginning, because you said it was 2 years before you began your sentence.
Yep.
What were those 2 years like? I mean, that had to be like the ultimate state of limbo.
For most people, it's the worst part is the leading up to prison. It's just, it's the not knowing, living in the, in that, in the hallway of not knowing. It was terrible in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In other ways, I was staying sober, you know, so that was a incredible part of the journey where I was learning about myself and growing. My wife, my ex-wife had kicked me out. So, and for good reason. And, but I'd also met a woman in AA who would later become my wife.
Nice.
And so it was strange, you know, because with so many difficult things going on, I found love again and acceptance, certainly found acceptance in the rooms of AA, but it was a kind of a love story that was developing. So,
yeah.
And what she saw in me, Bobby, I have no idea because I was not a good bet.
But that's beautiful though, you know, that it's also, I have to say, like, you stayed sober during a time when you could probably argue everything was kind of imploding.
Oh yeah. It was imploding.
It was imploding, right? I mean, that's, what do you think helped you to stay sober during that time?
You know, the, it's a great question because the one thing I found, you know, to skip ahead in the story, you know, I've worked with over 1,000 guys who've, who've gone through criminal justice issues at this point. And certainly something that a lot of us have in common is self-sabotage. You know, if I wanted to rename, like we have a white collar support group that meets on Monday nights, which we'll get to, but if I wanted to rename it, I would probably rename it Self-Sabotage Anonymous.
You know, we all need that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. It's not unique to people
I love that.
It's definitely not unique to people who are prosecuted for white collar crimes, but I could see how I had blown up my life and the wreckage, you know, caused great harm to the people I love and my kids and everything else. But I didn't have the tools to get out of my life in an elegant way. I just was not raised the right way, or I didn't have the right character, or I just didn't know how to get out of it. So to a very large extent, I wanted out of that life. But what I found was a new life. And this was the life I was given. So I didn't want to escape this life. I still don't want to escape it. And it's not like every day is a great, beautiful day. They're like anyone else. Days are days. Sometimes they're difficult. But I never want to escape this life. This is, you know, this is raw and beautiful. And I'm helping so many people and being helped by so many people.
Yeah.
It's a completely different existence.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, and you said something a minute ago, Jeff, when you said, you know, after the halfway house, and you said you weren't prepared for like that stage. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, when I went to prison, when I was even leading up to prison, and you noted those 2 years, there was no information out there. It was early internet.
Oh,
it wasn't right. Like now. It wasn't like now where you can get all this information. Like you wanted to look me up, I'm sure, and you Google me, and there's tons of stuff there. Back then, there wasn't that. And there was no one out there really being self-disclosing their stories. And that was one of the things that drove me to become a minister, that drove me to go to a seminary and want to help people. And even though I didn't quite understand that, I wanted to start a ministry to support people who've been prosecuted for white collar criminals and their families. I knew it was somewhere in there, you know what I mean? I knew I wanted to be in a helping profession and provide the kind of information for people so that they wouldn't have to go through it alone. You know, so, you know, the tagline of our ministry is it's the isolation that destroys us. The solution is in community. And we've really found out that that's true, because whether it's drugs or criminality or mental illness or whatever it happens to be, it's like living in that isolation, that prison of self is terrifying. And what happens is that you find, you probably find this with older people who live alone, you know, they become more and more, you know, less open to outside suggestions and more and more their They become more idiosyncratic. And it's like, you wonder, like, they don't really have a grip on what's going on in the world. And I understand that, because as an alcoholic or as someone who goes to AA, I recognize that I wake up every morning, maybe one degree off center. And so I go to a meeting every morning to put myself back on, you know, back on center. But like diverging lines, if you leave 1% go too long, the lines keep separating, and then it's hard to get back to reality.
Yeah, so, that is a great point.
So for me, it was just a matter of showing up and doing the next right thing and doing the job every day. Not something I understood before I got involved in all of this, but the showing up is so critical. So what happened was, I did go to seminary. I attended Union Theological Seminary. I had applied after about 2 years after I got out of prison, and they accepted me. And I got through seminary. I was a social ethics major. So there's the guy who'd gone to prison is majoring in ethics, which was intentional. There's no question. I mean, I wanted to get back on the beam.
That's right.
And from there, I worked as an associate pastor and director of prison ministries in an all Black and Latino church in Bridgeport, Connecticut. My wife and I were the only white people in the church. And it was an amazing experience. And it taught us about empathy and compassion and kind of cutting through all of these ridiculous ideas of what people are about, because we were finding the most beautiful people and the most accepting people were really in some of the most economically depressed situations we'd ever seen. And so we were living in Greenwich, which in an apartment, but we were living in this opulent, very wealthy place. And I was commuting to Bridgeport, and I was blogging about like the differences between Greenwich and Bridgeport, which are profound. They're only about 20 miles from each other. So there's one of the wealthiest communities and one of the poorest communities in the country. And how could they exist so side by side?
Yeah.
And I was working with guys in AA in Greenwich who were really captains of industry, also working with very, very poor people. So a reporter from a hedge fund magazine caught my blog and called me up and said, are you the minister to hedge funders? And I said to him, well, that's not really, I'm a minister and I work with hedge funders. Those concepts have never really come together. But I realized as soon as it came out of his mouth that my purpose had just presented itself. So my wife and I started this ministry to support people who were prosecuted for white collar crimes in their families. And we kind of took it on the road. We went to conferences and guest preached all over and just found that it was amazing that people were suffering and not, they didn't have a place to, an outlet for their suffering. And certainly they didn't have a place to find the tools to be able to navigate this. So we just started to grow, mostly because the media loves white collar stories. I mean, you know, it's just more now, by the way, than even then. And I was doing that full time and we were growing. We had started a support group that meets on Monday nights. In fact, on March 14th, so in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we'll have our 300th meeting.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's all on Zoom. So
amazing.
All of this like social distancing stuff, we've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
We were way ahead of the curve.
And that's awesome though.
Yep. And mostly people I've never met in person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And I'm curious, how many people have come through?
Over 1,000 into the ministry and over 450 people on the support group calls.
Wow. And do you have that many on, like how many people are on an average Monday night?
40 probably.
Man,
you know, we'll
that's
have
awesome.
We'll have double that for the 300th meeting, because, you know, a lot of people will come back and we'll get a lot of media attention around that probably. But, you know, there is a sweet spot as to how the right amount of people so that people can participate. If it gets too large, then it's more like a webinar. And I like when it's small, frankly, because
Yeah.
And because then we can really get personal.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of curious, like what on these calls, is it like, what's the, I guess, what's the format? What happens on them?
It's surprisingly like an AA meeting or a 12-step meeting, because that's where I learn my chops, but it's facilitated because there's a lot of legal issues and things. Not that we offer legal advice, but we have to prevent, certainly recommend to people that they don't talk about the intricacies of their case if their case is still pending.
Right.
Yeah. And if they've just come out of prison, for example, people need the permission of their probation officer or their parole officer to come on. And because we've developed the track record and because we have a website and everything else, then the probation officers can see that a lot of them know us at this point, but they see that we're a professional organization and we're there to help. We're not, you know, a bunch of criminals conspiring how to knock off a bank or something.
Right.
And which is what probation officers care about, let's face it. So we say the Serenity Prayer. Interestingly, one of our members, who is a Catholic priest, a Catholic bishop. I'm a Catholic priest, by the way, he's my bishop. He was formerly the county sheriff of Bergen County, New Jersey. So, and he got brought down in a corruption scandal. So he's a felon. So here we have a guy who 20 years ago was a cop, had 700 cops working for him, ran the Bergen County jail. Got brought down and has his own redemption story. So he's on and he's leading us in prayer on Monday nights. And we're talking about things that are real, you know, and so if there are new people who come on, we introduce ourselves and we try to draw out people into participating, and we share announcements and resource sharing. And then every Monday night, someone has a topic lead. And so the topic lead can be gratitude. It could be resentments. It can be something very practical, like how does your family survive the breadwinner being away for 2 years? This podcast happens to be on a Monday. So tonight's topic is our suggestion box, where we ask everyone what suggestions they have for the next year, is what topics they'd like us to have. And so, and then everyone gets to share, anyone who wants to share.
Wow.
And it runs about 75 minutes. But if it winds up to having a spirited conversation, we'll leave it open for another 15 or 30 minutes so people can talk. And then the most important part of the group is that people communicate offline. You know, it's not the hour or 75 minutes we talk on Mondays. It's all these different rich relationships that people develop.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the criminal justice system can be very harsh, and mostly because they control all the information and they control all the prosecution information and all of that. But because we share all of our information, we've actually have some power. We have knowledge is power. So it gives us the ability not to be exploited or taken advantage of so much anymore. So what a gift that is.
I can only imagine, because I think it was Craig who said, or it was someone else I was talking to, but it's when you come out of the prison, you're not like, it's hard to get a job. It's, you lose a lot of your community. So I can see where having a place where you can kind of come together would be so helpful. And that leads me to a question about your tagline, you know, and it's the isolation that destroys us. The solution is community. Can you tell me more about, because that resonates for me. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, mostly this came out of the study I did in seminary, because I studied underground economies within the ethics area of the seminary. It was really about ethics on the ground. I mean, there was certainly a lot of philosophical and theological ethics, but really on the ground, how are we treating one another? I went to seminary at the time of Occupy Wall Street. So in my seminary, my classmates were very involved in Occupy Wall Street, and was basically, they were protesting social inequities and economic inequities and racial inequities. And I was one of the one percenters. You know, I was a guy who did very well before I got brought down. And so I was, in a way, I was kind of an outcast in the seminary, you know, because It's not usual. I mean, certainly you don't get a lot of white collar criminals in the seminary, but you also don't get people who have had such dramatic financial success and then lost it. And so my best friends in seminary were really people who I could relate to on a level of suffering, and I could relate to on a level of being bound by our brokenness. So my closest friends were the trans people. And this was really years before the trans movement, which I'm grateful for. I'm grateful that everybody has, it seems like in many ways we've moved to a more inclusiveness in a lot of things. Of course, there's a lot of backlash, politically to that kind of thing, obviously. So in learning about the underground economy and what it is to be a kind of a refugee, not having, no longer having a home, not being welcome in one place and not being welcome in a new place, but kind of living in this refugee society or this refugee existence in between, I learned how people survived in a new community. I mean, it's not like, for example, Korean Americans no longer being Korean and not being treated as Americans. They're being treated somewhere in between, at least for a lot of years. I'm not sure if that's so true anymore. So here we are, people have been prosecuted for white collar crimes. We're no longer invited, or we've been kicked out of our old lives, and we're aspiring to new lives. But we're not really welcome in those new lives, not welcome in business, not welcome. So we have to create our own community. And that was just a theory. We didn't know. I didn't have no idea if it was going to work. But in many ways, what's happened is that we've found ways to lift ourselves up and to no longer be victims. And it's incredible when you let the power of that just kind of roll out, and people want to give of themselves, and they want to help one another. And I had a model that I had to embody that and model that, kind of be a power of example for that, even as I didn't really understand it. It was like fake it till you make it kind of stuff. I was doing the best I could, even though I was accomplishing things. And certainly within the last year, since I was reinstated to the bar in New York, so I'm a lawyer again. And last year also, we had this article about us, about the White Collar Support Group in the New Yorker. Those two events last year, my reinstatement and the New Yorker article, kind of lifted up the whole community. It broke the glass ceiling where, wait a second, maybe if Jeff can do it, maybe I can do it too. Or maybe there's more understanding of how we're our own worst enemies. That yes, there's a lot of stigma out there for sure. But am I so traumatized that I've been refusing to embrace life and start over in a meaningful way? And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And if that's not unique to people prosecuted for white collar crimes, we live such long lives these days that almost everybody is affected by some kind of trauma.
That's right.
Divorce, death of a child, whatever it happens to be. And so these are universal themes that we've been able to put out into the world and get a lot of feedback from people how they've overcome their life difficulties.
Yeah. I love what you said there, Jeff. After the trauma, I think you said, have I been refusing to embrace life?
Yeah.
I can see how that could happen. And like you say, it's not just, for a white collar criminal, and just in so many coming out of COVID, just so many different things. The other thing that you said earlier, and I was thinking about this before the interview as well, but you said, what a gift, because now you got to this beautiful life and everything. And one of the things I'm taking a course in is positive intelligence, PQ. And it's fascinating. And they talk about how some of the worst things that we can experience, and it's not pleasant at the time, obviously, you might not want to go through it again. But once you make it through it, there's a point where you can see the gift in it. Yeah. And like a classic example is Christopher Reeves, after being thrown from the horse, he dedicated his life to spinal cord research and everything. A classic example. And it occurs to me, that's a little bit what I'm hearing here. Like, you know, you've started something that I'm sure back in 2000, this was not on your radar to do something like this, you know, to have this become a minister and have this ministry and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I certainly didn't wake up the day after I tried to kill myself as a Jewish lawyer in New York with the idea, wait a second, I'll become a Catholic priest to an independent Catholic priest to people with white collar backgrounds. No, that certainly wasn't a thought that came to me the next morning.
It was a big jump if it did.
Yeah, there were a lot of little decisions along the way. The thing about being a lawyer now is that I've become in many ways a general counsel to the white collar community, you know, because what happens is that there are criminal lawyers out there, and a lot of them are gifted. A lot of them are fine criminal lawyers, but none of them have the lived experience or understand what it really is to be in the shoes of actually being prosecutor for a white collar crime. And also, their jobs are very limited. I mean, they're supposed to get you to sentencing, and they get you the best sentence that you can, and then they never see you again. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that what I've learned personally, and with working with over 1,000 guys as their minister, as their helper or navigator, is that it's very complicated, and going to prison is not the worst thing that can happen. The worst thing that can happen is not having a comeback story. And so if you're not preparing from the very beginning to have a comeback story, then almost without exception, you wake up 10 years later and you look back and you say, if I had known then what I know now, I would have made a lot of different decisions. And so everybody pours their resources into their criminal case. And you can understand they're scared to death and they're afraid of what things they don't know, as you kind of just said, you know, maybe the things we don't know are the best things for us sometimes, but they're afraid. But there's a lot of other aspects to it. There's legal aspects, there's tax and bankruptcy and divorce lawyer and real estate lawyers and all kinds of intricacies, forensics. And then there's medical things and there's mental things. Maybe there's psychiatrists and psychologists and mitigation experts. And then there's the long story. I mean, what decisions can I make now that are going to best give me the best chance for a recovery and the best chance for a comeback later down the road? And criminal lawyers aren't going to help you with any of that.
No,
none of it. They don't even understand it. They also don't understand like what's going on in the prisons and what are the not just prison preparedness, but for example, right now you've probably read that under the CARES Act and under the First Step Act, they're letting people out of prisons early. So what does it mean to be involved in a criminal prosecution where you're being given options because you're almost certainly going to plea? Virtually no cases go to trial. So you're going to plea, and under the plea agreement, there's going to be X amount of time you'll spend in prison. Well, if your lawyer doesn't understand that the prisons are letting people out early, how can they advise you as to how much time you will actually spend in prison? Mm. So they know what they know. And I'm not, and most of them are know it well. I mean, I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying it's a very incomplete way of looking at a very complex problem.
Yeah. And I'm intrigued by something you said earlier, that the worst thing is not going to prison. The worst thing is, how'd you say it, not having a comeback story.
Yeah.
So how do you help prepare someone to create their comeback story?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to, I hate that expression. The first thing I do.
Nice.
The first thing I do. How's that for a shift?
That's a good shift.
The first thing I do is try to introduce them to as many people as I possibly can who have been through the full range of the experiences, because they're generally operating under very narrow conditions, very narrow set of facts. Example, someone gets arrested. Let's say you got arrested, Bobby.
Okay.
Let's say you got arrested. You got arrested. The FBI comes, they knock, they bash down your door 20 agents ransack your house. It's dramatic.
Yeah.
But you know you need a lawyer. You know you need a criminal lawyer. Where would you find one? I assume you don't have a criminal defense attorney's phone numbers hanging by your phone. So you start asking around. But who do you ask? You ask if you have a corporate lawyer. If you have you call your corporate lawyer, you call your brother-in-law, you call anybody. My God, this just happened to me. I need a lawyer. And people say to you, oh, you got to call so-and-so. He's great. He's the best ever. And you call him or her. And I didn't mean for that to be sexist. You call them. And you just want the pain to stop. You just want the pain to stop. And so for something that's really a temporary problem, the problem is temporary, because what you really need to do is you need to get through the early moment, whatever it is, the arraignment, whatever. And then your business sense would tell you, wait, take a step back. What do I need? What team do I need to put together? But you're so traumatized and you're so in such pain that you'll actually commit to people and write them huge checks based upon a set of facts and circumstances that you don't understand yourself. It's like your business sense, you abdicate all of your business sense and all of your decision-making to someone who says that they can solve your problem. And then almost invariably, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months later, you're now have calmed down a little bit. Maybe you found our support group by then. I said, wait a second. How do I even know that this is the right lawyer for me? How do I know what questions am I supposed to ask? How do I know that they have the right background? How do I feel about I'm putting my life in these people's hands? And I understand, because this is the way we've been trained. I mean, we think Perry Mason is going to come, or it's going to be like on Law and Order, right? Like, and it's just not the way it is. Mm-hmm. And so to have a pool of resources that is trauma aware, and the professionals are, at least in my case, trauma informed, and understand that, you know, we have to move through these things with a sense of order. There really is a better way of navigating all of this that's going to potentially lead to a much better outcome. But you have to be willing to be open enough to what that means. And yeah. I believe that can only come from people giving you enough information from a lot of different sources. And so once you've spoken to, I don't know, 10, 15 other people who've been through it, start to sort the information and say, wait a second, I don't have to be such a victim here. I can make better choices. But yet most people still bathe in their victimhood. They're so traumatized and they're so, you know, they feel so badly. They've destroyed their lives. They've destroyed their families. They're buying into a narrative that's true, and feels filled with so much shame that they're willing to sign away the farm.
Yeah.
What a bad idea that is.
What it really sounds like to me is how important it is to survive like that first wave of the trauma.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes sense, you know, no matter what the trauma is, but mm-hmm. your life has just changed, right? Your old life, it's just changed.
It's over.
It's over, you know? And so to survive that makes perfect sense to me. So I know we're getting close to our time. But I wanted to ask you a final question before, and then I'll open it up to like how people can reach you and everything. But first, if people are feeling like they're, I don't know, that they're isolated or they're stuck in that space, maybe they're self-sabotaging, what would be, I don't know, a couple pieces of advice that you might have for them about how they can move forward?
You ask good questions, Bobby.
I try, Jeff.
I would say that the earlier you engage, obviously, the better. So people are generally locked into their way of life, their business way of life, their personal way of life. And very few people, when things are starting to topple, or when you hit or you're reaching the tipping point, very few people are able to go into the bedroom and talk to their spouse and say, listen, this is not working. This is not working. I'm not capable of earning what I thought we would be able to earn. We're living over our heads. Maybe I'm not the person I thought I was. I need help, or I'm under such stress. I need some kinds of professional help. Very few people are able to do that. And the reason that they're unable to do that, almost universally, we found, is that, let's just say, in the 10-year run-up to that point, when they're young people and trying to make it in the world and they're in finance or whatever they're doing, you know, they've become bad partners. They've become emotionally unavailable to their partner. So now they're there and they're talking to their spouse or they're talking to their partner, and they're afraid that if they tell their partner, we need to sell the house, we need to get rid of the cars, we need to simplify, they're afraid their partner will leave them. Because without the money, if you've not been a good partner and you've separated yourself emotionally, what's left? So they're afraid to be real. They're afraid to be honest. They're afraid that, and almost without exception, when we've interviewed the partner afterwards, the partner has said, I would have liked nothing better than my spouse to have come and been real with me. And I miss the person I married. I miss that. And so people aren't communicating. They're not being real with one another. But so,
yeah.
So the first thing I would say is that you're better off with healthy conflict right there, or health, than you are just forging ahead, thinking things will get better. They're not going to get better if you're crossing over onto the other side ethically. They're not going to get better. So that's one. Two, obviously, having the right partner is important. It's probably the biggest decision of your life.
Yeah.
And three, and this is so, if I'm asked by students all the time when I lecture at colleges or law schools, I'm asked this question all the time. What's the one thing that you would do differently? The one thing. And the answer is, I would have lived within my means.
Yeah.
Because without the pressure, then you don't have to make those decisions. I mean, I'm a lawyer again, and believe me, there's a little bit of a little anxiety about, wait a second, you know, the last time I was a lawyer, things didn't work out so well. And so the big answer is, one, I have the relationship I have with my wife is very, very different than in my first marriage. And that's because, well, not just because I married someone else who was with me through all of the problems, but I'm different. And two, we are sworn to live within our means.
Yeah.
And Bobby, frankly, I'm a much better lawyer now than I was back then. I have, not only do I have the wisdom of age, but all the things I've seen and all the, and it would be very easy for it to go to my head.
That's, you know, right.
It would be very easy to see myself in a different way. One, that's why I go to AA every morning, to keep myself in check.
Two,
every single morning. And two, that way didn't work. You know, it's like I confused who I am with what my office was, with what my job was. Mm-hmm. And so I don't choose to view myself any longer as a lawyer, meaning having some kind of elevated view in society. If anything else, that's my job. And when I can remember who I am, I'm a child of God. And so what a humbling place that is, you know, give the glory to God. And also I'm an emissary. My job is to try to make the world better.
Yeah. I love that. That's great. It's so great advice in there, right? The don't live beyond your means, and also the healthy conflict. Mm-hmm. You know, my husband, Rick, and I, we've been together for a little bit over 20 years now. Mm-hmm. I think we're going on 23 years, but we haven't been married that whole time, but together, that's a long time. And one of the things that we've always valued in our partnership is that we discuss the undiscussable, you know, and if there's something that is, you know, and I'm probably more the one that will bring it up, but if there's something that's off a little bit, I'll bring it up to say, not because I want to argue, but hey, what do we do? You know, how can we work through this? So how can someone learn more about you or connect to you if they want to?
Well, the ministry is, we have a website for the ministry and a website for the law firm. The ministry is Progressive Prison Ministries, or you can look my name up, Jeff Grant. If you Google me, I'm kind of like all over this space. Again, just because there's nobody else who's doing white collar ministry, and who would? Why would anybody?
Someone with this experience.
Why would anybody do this if you didn't have to? But it's prisonist.org. So that's prisonist like feminist, prisonist.org. Wow. And the law firm is grantlaw.com. So I was lucky enough to preserve that name for the last 20 years, waiting, hopefully, maybe I would get my law license back.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'll put those in the show notes. And other than that, Jeff, I just want to thank you for sharing your story and for the work that you're doing. You're making a difference for a lot of people.
Thank you, Bobby. And this is a wonderful experience. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. Here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, have some ritual that centers you every day. Jeff talked about feeling, you know, that 1% off when he wakes up, which is why he goes to an AA meeting every day. I never thought about it quite that way before, but recently I started a guided meditation practice. And if you've listened to the podcast before, you know that this is something that has felt like a struggle for me to do meditation. Sitting still probably is not my specialty in life, but I found a 12-minute guided meditation where I can move around and do stretches, etc. But it is focused on calming the mind and really feeling the movement within your body. And it reminds you when your mind starts to wander to bring it back. And that works on your self-control muscle, as they call it. So it works really well for me. But anyway, a few weeks ago, I started doing this every morning upon rising. And it's been super valuable. Like I notice a difference in my energy. I feel more grounded and more centered. So it's been great. Now this past weekend, for some reason, I skipped both Saturday and Sunday. And I noticed that today, as I woke up, I wasn't feeling quite as grounded or as centered as what I had been. So I did my meditation today and things feel more centered and it's all great. So when Jeffrey said that 1% misalignment, you know, that's not terrible if it's just 1%. But if we go too long, you know, now we're getting more and more away from centered, you know, so it has that cumulative effect. And it was a good reminder that, for me anyway, that having that routine, that ritual that helps me be centered every day is a great practice for me. Insight number two, if you're going through something challenging, it is helpful to have a team of people around you. And ideally, a team of people who have been there and who understands where you are now and what your challenges look like and how to go forward. And finally, insight number three, embrace healthy conflict, as Jeff calls it. To me, this means being willing to discuss the undiscussable and to have the courage to bring up things early before they become a crisis and while they are still small enough to deal with. On an earlier episode, Josh Freeman he used the analogy of dealing with things, you know, while the train is still in the station, you know, not once it's worked up a full head of steam. So those are my three insights. And that wraps up this episode. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and for listening. I greatly appreciate it and I appreciate you. I recently have had a number of messages, people reaching out to me saying that the podcast is adding value to them. And that makes me happy. That's exactly why I started it almost 2 years ago. And if you are finding value, I hope that you'll leave us a review on Apple or share an episode with a friend. So until next time, I hope that you have an amazing week and make sure that you thrive no matter what.